It's Wednesday, December 6, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons here in studio today, while my colleagues Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley are joining me via Skype. On our program this week, presenting the doomsday case to America, we're going to talk about Liz Cheney's new book and the December issue of The Atlantic in the picture that both are painting of an America once again ruled by Donald Trump. Why the Alameda County District Attorney shut an Oakland, California reporter out of a news conference and what finally made that DA reverse her decision. And a Harvard professor says Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg's large donation is behind her ouster from a position as professor. We're going to talk about what she says happened and how she's fighting it. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to today before our half hour is up, but we're going to start today's program with news that broke just before 8 o'clock local time this morning, and that's the death of Norman Lear. The 101-year-old screenwriter and producer developed more than 100 shows. He is best known for creating and producing some of the most popular sitcoms of the 1970s, including All in the Family and its spinoff, The Jeffersons, Maude, Sanford and Son, One Day at a Time, and Good Times. Ernest, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a short time, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, when I was considering getting a graduate degree in history and was going to focus my research on the impact of Lear's work on the civil rights movement in the 70s and how his characters exposed the racism, the classism, the sexism and discrimination in our society and created learning moments around them that used humor in a unique and effective way.
I would say that he had an impact when it came to how American families and Americans in general actually looked at those issues. I mean, prior to, I would say, All in the Family, which sort of began a lot of this, but prior to that, many of those issues you just didn't see in television, in sitcoms or in dramatic shows. They were just things that they didn't talk about. But once Archie Bunker and Edith Bunker and the entire cast of All in the Family appeared on, I mean, that show skyrocketed to number one because it was dealing with issues that people were dealing with on a daily basis and what a lot of people are talking about in their normal lives that television just didn't trust that the American people could actually see that in their on the television screen and act appropriately and do things appropriately. So, I mean, for that reason alone, I think Norman Lear had a powerful impact on American society and how we see ourselves in particular during the 1970s and 1980s.
And that legacy was carried on. I mean, you talk about Archie Bunker is this character who was both among the biggest bigots that some of us could have ever encountered, you know, in real life or fictionally. And at the same time had this weird endearing quality that we could somehow relate to. And that legacy would carry itself straight through. I read earlier today that even in the early 2000s that he was collaborating with the creators of South Park and that, in fact, they created the Eric Cartman character, the Respect My Authority guy. But even a cartoon character that was modeled after Archie Bunker, or even the idea that some of those iconic shows are popping back up today, One Day at a Time having a reboot that focused on a Latinx family with an LGBTQ daughter, and grandma was always in the picture in that program. Rita Moreno starring in that role. And in fact, I even read today, too, that there's an expected reboot of Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman.
Wow, I mean, that's, I didn't know about that. I mean,
that's in the New York Times story that's on our Lynx blog.
Great. Well, I mean, these reboots sort of speak to the fact that we're still dealing with these issues. And there are ways in which we as a society need to see those in our television viewing. I mean, what I'm going to see is whether or not that happens in a way that can really connect, because right now in our current landscape, everything is streamed. People are watching and watching shows in various different ways. Are they going to get that sort of, this is what we're dealing with in our everyday lives?
That's a really
in these particular shows.
That's a really interesting point. Kathy, when we talked about that idea in the 1970s, everybody would watch that same episode of Good Times that may be focusing on issues of poverty and discrimination. Seeing that episode in real time on TV that night, perhaps talking about it the next day, some of these reboots and streaming may not maybe have some of that same kind of impact that comes from the collective experience?
Well, I think that. I also think that one of the striking things is what you just said about Lear's sort of iconic creation, which was Archie Bunker, and that is Archie Bunker was a very nuanced portrait of a bigot. And we need that kind of nuance as we prepare to go home for the holidays, right, and talk to the Archies around our table. And I think Lear created a space for that. I think it's really, in some ways, I think for younger people, it's hard to understand his impact, because TV wouldn't be what it is today without him. He opened doors and allowed people to see things and showed how people really are in a very mature way. And I think the question today is, it's not just a matter of the streaming, Amy. It's a matter of, in an era of social media, when it's so easy to throw pot shots from a distance and not know the people you're attacking, or not try to know the people you're disagreeing with, are people prepared for somebody as nuanced as Archie Bunker, the guy who was a bigot but was still dad, right? And so I think that's the question. And I think you're right, the fact that we are watching what we want to watch, and we are increasingly, by algorithms, reading the news that we already agree with, I think that makes it much more difficult to have that kind of artistic accomplishment that Lear did, which is to show people in all their shades of gray.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that he really added. I mean, when you look at his shows, he was able to sort of present this, in particular, he was able to present African Americans as a non-monolithic community. I mean, you had Good Times, which showed the poverty and the discrimination in housing projects. But then you also had the Jeffersons, on the other hand, which showed the success and what can happen when African Americans are given the opportunity to be able to be successful small business owners, and how that can help propel them. And then you had Sanford and Son, which showed another aspect of African American life that actually intermingles not only with white society, but also with Hispanic society and others. That was one of the things that he brought in, is that, you know, the United States is a microcosm of all of these communities and all of these cultures and social and ethnic groups. And it's difficult to see that in today's television, because people have the ability to be able to go into their own little rabbit holes and stay there and not see what all of that is, and how the country is actually not this monolithic group of people, but it's all one thing.
So this has been a rough week as we look at those across American culture. If it's the cultural side, the television and entertainment side of Norman Lear, we've also lost nonagenarians and centurions in government as well. And I want to take some time to also remember some others who left indelible marks on 20th century U.S. history. This past week, it's been Henry Kissinger and Sandra Day O'Connor. And there were some very stark differences in the coverage of each of their deaths. Kathy O'Connor was very much a trailblazing moderate to be on the Supreme Court, that moderate that we didn't know that we needed. And there seemed to have been a lot of remembering of that and trying to talk about how she united the country, and contrasting on almost the same day with coverage of Henry Kissinger, who was framed in a lot of it as a war criminal.
Well, O'Connor, of course, was the first woman on the Supreme Court. So for that landmark achievement, you know, there's a lot of history that goes with that. And she opened, I mean, you talk about breaking a glass ceiling, she did it. She was somebody who was really well-liked and less controversial. I think there are probably some conservatives who weren't too happy with some of the decisions she made, but somebody who played it down the middle. One thing I would like to say about Sandra Day O'Connor that wasn't mentioned in a lot of the coverage of her was her work after she left the court on behalf of civics education. She founded the group iCivics, which our own journalism institute here, the Reynolds Journalism Institute, has worked with.
And I use a lot of their stuff in some of my classes.
Yes, and did some marvelous, marvelous work. So she remained, I mean, the interesting thing about O'Connor is she was a very had a very traditional trajectory. She had to drop out of the workforce for a while to raise her children because she said she didn't have anybody to take care of them. And so she came back in. She served as a legislator. She served in state courts. She was a political activist and then became a Supreme Court justice. And she brought a lot of that experience with her to the court, which I think informed her decisions and probably made her the very pragmatic justice that she was. Kissinger also shaped by his life experiences as a refugee from Nazi Germany and was somebody who was always trying to achieve stability. I won't call it peace, I would say stability. And he was a strong believer in balance of power. The reason he's so controversial is that in order to achieve that balance of power, he was willing to ally the United States with some less than savory countries and characters. And certainly the history of the secret bombing of Cambodia will go down as one of the worst marks on American foreign policy. But I also think that one of the most remarkable things about Henry Kissinger was not just his longevity in terms of years, but the fact that he continued to be consulted even up until days before his death. Mm-hmm. Really, he was giving speeches, and current world leaders were continuing to consult him and wanted to be seen with him or show that he was part of their entourage. So you talk about a guy who knew how to amass power and keep it. You may disagree with the way he did it, but he certainly was a player from his first entrance into the adult world to the very, very last.
Yeah, one of the things I will say about, you know, about Kissinger was that he was both revered and feared, even by presidents. I mean, it was almost as if, you know, you had Kissinger on one side and J. Edgar Hoover on the other, between the two of them, they were able to amass power in their particular spheres of influence in ways that you just don't see that today. I think that there are some out there who would like to have that kind of influence, but I think in today's political climate, it's just not possible. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was still being sought after for guidance and information, because he was one of the few who was able to do that. But again, like you said very eloquently, Kathy, he did it in some very unscrupulous ways. I mean, not only the secret bombing in Cambodia, the destabilization of Chile, many of the problems that we have in Central America, all goes back to policies that were initiated and basically planned by Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, and we can't let this, you know, the last word on him has to include the fact that he opened relations with China. Mm-hmm. Yep. That was a remarkable achievement, and again, you know, an ambiguous one, right? But still, but you know, I think you think about how people are shaped by their personal backgrounds, and of course, Sandra Day O'Connor grew up on a ranch. She said, "I grew up on the back of a horse," but Henry Kissinger grew up a refugee, and I think. You can understand why somebody who had that experience might well think that strength and being feared is something to be sought after. So maybe the moral of the story is let's try not to make so many refugees.
I mean, I think you brought up a point about Sandra Day O'Connor. She, you know, she brought moderation to a court that could have swung conservative back when she was appointed. And I think that's what many conservatives, in particular, I would say some of the social conservatives, expected when she was named to the court. And that didn't necessarily happen. And I think a lot of it goes back to her pragmatism, the fact that she looked at it in terms of what's in the best interest of the entire nation and not just a particular political or ideological portion of the country.
So tonight, the remaining field of GOP presidential hopefuls will take the stage in Tuscaloosa for their fourth debate to be televised on the News Nation cable network. In the background of that, other voices are trying to out-talk them, warning of the dangers ahead if one of them end up losing out on the nomination to former President Donald Trump. The Atlantic's December issue is out as well, and it focuses entirely on this topic with pieces written by different staffers. And yesterday, Liz Cheney's new book, Oath and Honor, hit store shelves. She's been on a nonstop media tour promoting it. And here's a clip from a feature that was on CBS Sunday Morning.
You say Donald Trump, if he is reelected, it will be the end of the republic. What do you mean?
He's told us what he will do. People who say, well, if he's elected, it's not that dangerous because we have all of these checks and balances, don't fully understand the extent to which the Republicans in Congress today have been co-opted. One of the things that we see happening today is a sort of a sleepwalking into a dictatorship in the United States.
It's a big word, and it's no question that it's a really strong position to take. But Kathy, it's not that much unlike what I've heard you and several others say. She's out to sell books, of course, but maybe it's not so hyperbolic?
No, I mean, I think Donald Trump has been pretty clear about what he wants to do if he gets a second term. We saw how hard he fought to not give up, you know, after the first term. And, you know, violating a lot of all the norms of about a peaceful transfer of power. So, and I think it's been clear in his public statements, he wants to use the legal system to go after any of his political opponents. Those are all earmarks of somebody who wants to be a dictator and does not want to abide by the checks and balances that are involved in our republic. And I think what's interesting about Cheney, who is a very conservative Republican, she is concerned about the body in which she served, the House of Representatives, which should be part of that checks and balances. And what she talks about, I haven't had a chance to read the book, but I've read some of the excerpts and read the reviews and certainly heard some of her interviews. What she's really talking about is how people have given up kind of that role, that checks and balances role, and said, you know, well, whatever the president says, we're going to go along. And that's not the way Congress is supposed to work. But one of the things that's happening, and again, this is a hallmark of a dictatorship, is intimidation. People are afraid. And Cheney talks a lot about this, people coming up to her and saying, I know you're right, but if I vote for impeachment, I'm worried about my family. And so we're seeing people, you know, with maybe some genuine concern, but putting their own personal situation ahead of the country. And that's a dangerous place to be.
So, Ernest, go ahead. You were about to say something. I apologize.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think Kathy brings up some very good points. I mean, just not just about Trump, but the Republican Party in general. I mean, just today, Kevin McCarthy, the former speaker, has announced that he is not running for re-election, so he's going to leave office. I think it was yesterday, the interim speaker, who had taken over after McCarthy had unceremoniously been booted out, he's announced that he's not going to run for re-election. And it all points to the kind of intimidation that Kathy is talking about. I mean, these people are basically saying, hey, I'm out. And it's not just about being primaried. It's also about what's happening on social media, what's happening in real time and in real life, not only to them, but their families. And that is a danger to the Republic.
And so as we talk about that and the danger to the Republic, Ernest, what I was just about to ask you is, now that we're about 40 days out or so from the casting of the first primary votes, what is the playbook? How do you set up the coverage? As we're starting to hear some of this, we see what The Atlantic has. There are some other op-eds you can find on our links blog that's like, enough with the fatalism already. What is the approach that we take? What do we need to take? What steps do we need to take? What steps do our audiences want for us to take? And how do we work with those?
You know, I'm not sure, Amy. And the reason why I'm sort of at a loss is because we're even more siloed now than we were the previous election. And I thought that was pretty siloed. I mean, it is hard to break through from one silo to the next silo to actually reach people. And on top of all of that, I think people are generally tired. They see nothing has changed. It is still the same gridlock. We're still arguing over who won the last election. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ridiculous. But that's kind of where we are. And everyone, I mean, I won't say everyone, but a lot of people they're sitting back and they're waiting for the courts to act and all of these trials that the former president is involved in, waiting for them to do something to give them a reason to say, no, he can't run for president because he's been convicted of this or convicted of that. And that may not happen because his lawyers are doing a pretty effective job of stalling these trials. So if you're waiting for the court to be the one to be the arbiter of whether or not he can run for election, I think that's not something that we can hang our hats on. But as journalism and the news media as a whole is going to have a tough time because they're going to be bouncing from silo to silo to silo trying to cover this election.
Okay, we have about 6 minutes left in our show today. A couple of quick hits I want to make sure that we get to. Kathy, this next story is one you brought to my attention out west in California. The Alameda County District Attorney put a journalist back on her media contact list after having removed the woman over a security risk. Has there been any explanation as to what that perceived risk was? Or was this kind of just the retaliation that we've been talking about in different forms and fashion in different places over the last few months?
Well, you know, Amy, Trumpism by any other name smells just as bad. And, you know, this is the problem that when this DA in Alameda County is a very liberal Democrat. And she did not like the coverage that this particular reporter was providing of crime and some of the other issues in that part of the world. And so she used the fact that this reporter was working for a one-woman band. She had created a website and a news site to just cover crime in Alameda County, which is the home of Berkeley and Oakland, for those viewers who don't know. But this is a tactic right out of President Trump's playbook. Just, you don't like the reporter, you just find some reason to not let them into a press conference. And I think what happened here is, to the everlasting credit of the other reporters in Alameda County, they rose up and stood up for their colleague and protested this, including competing organizations, which I think was smart because the next time it could be you. And I think that's what ultimately caused the DA. It wasn't just locally, but then when the word got out, you know, a lot of people were raising a fuss about this. And I think the DA was probably ultimately looking at a court case being brought against her office. So that did the trick. But this is the type of thing that we've opened the door to. Censorship, you know, it's right out of, so that's why I don't think dictatorship is that far-fetched. I mean, we're seeing some of the symptoms right here, right now.
Okay, before we go, I want to lighten things up a little bit and bring back something we didn't really have time for last week. And as we're heading into the holiday season, what better to talk about than blockbuster movies? Or movies which would have been blockbusters once upon a time and now are just, well, busting out.
But it's not over.
My work is inevitable. There will always be more to finish it.
That's a clip from Disney's The Marvels, which came out about 3 weeks ago. It's a sequel to Captain Marvel and cost something like $200 million to produce. Its first week ticket sales, though, a paltry $46 million, the worst open for a Marvel Studios movie in its history. Now, for the longest time, Marvel had been the envy of the entertainment industry, turning out hit after hit after hit. Now, there's some chance, Ernest, that the actors' strike may have led to some of this problem in terms of, like, not having the promotional events or red carpets. But there are others that are out there that are just saying Marvel movies are not what they once were. You're our Marvel guy.
Well, I actually saw the movie on Friday, and I thought it was pretty good. I mean, it lacked some of the things that you would have seen in previous Marvel movies, but I think it was pretty good. Here's a lot of the problem. Number one, you had the Screen Actors strike, which hurt promotions, obviously, and Marvel promotes its movies big time before they premiere. So that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that we're coming out of COVID and theaters are still having issues with getting the public back in to watch movies. And part of that comes from everything was streamed during COVID and afterwards. And a lot of what you see in these movies are sort of outgrowths of streaming. So they're trying to basically take that and put it back in the theater. And the question is, can you put it back in the bottle? And right now, they're struggling with that. And so we're going to see. I mean, as far as the superhero movies go, you got Aquaman that's going to be coming out. We'll see whether or not whether or not there's going to be an issue with that in the same vein. Napoleon, which is a huge movie and a long movie, I think it's doing okay, but it's also struggling. The Martin Scorsese movie,
Killer of the Flower Moon, that seems to be underperforming as well from
Under, that movie is underperforming, and I think a lot of it goes back to the difficulty that of getting people back into the theater now that they've become accustomed to streaming them online. They'll just say, hey, I'll wait a month or I'll wait 2 months until it's out on streaming and I'll watch it there. So I think we're going to have to actually move away from basically what's happening in the theaters as a metric of the success of a movie to how's it doing on stream.
Okay. Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today, and one that we didn't, that one about the professor at Harvard who's saying that she is being retaliated against because of the nature of her research. That's all on our links blog, which is under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, to Kia Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher composed our theme music, and Nate Brown our social media.